Hello and welcome to What is YA Anyway? I am your host, Emma Q. Bellis, and I am so excited for today's episode. I have scholar John Ostenson on. He is a professor at Brigham and Young University, and before that, he was a high school English teacher. In this episode, we focus on young adult dystopian fiction. It is a fascinating field that is really had a heyday back in the 2010s and is still an incredibly popular genre among young adults and adults alike. We discuss the validity of this genre, the validity of young adult literature in general, how to teach young adult literature to both high schoolers and college students, the state of young adult dystopia today, some of the roots of young adult dystopia, the importance of compelling storylines, compelling characters, the relationships that they have, and then we dive into where the dystopia genre is going from here, and also what about a young adult text makes it worthy of study and worthy of teaching. Like I said, it is a great episode, and I can't wait for you to listen. So without further ado, here it is. Hi, and welcome to the show, John.
Thanks.
You're on What is YA Anyway? I am Emma Q. Bellis. I'm going to be hosting today. I'm so happy to have you here to discuss young adult literature. But before we dive into our conversation, can you tell us a bit about yourself, where you work, just how you got into this, basic things?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm currently an associate professor at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, and I've been here since 2007. For the decade or so before that, I taught junior high and high school English while I was getting a master's and then finishing up a PhD in that transition time. Young adult literature has always been something that I've been interested in, first as a teacher, because I wanted to motivate students to read. They didn't, you know, unsurprisingly, they didn't find the Scarlet Letter super exciting, but Twilight, they were eating it up. And so, you know, just wanting to get them to read young adult literature mattered a lot to me. And I loved it myself. I found it compelling literature. When I came to the university, I had the opportunity to teach our young adult literature course here that we offer for English majors. And so it's a more literary approach to the genre. And that's what sort of introduced me to the idea that you could study young adult literature as a critical object, you know, that you could pursue looking at it in the way we look at English literature or British or American literature or what have you. And so that's been a part of my career that I've tried to keep active. I'm focused right now. I have an administrative / teaching role where I oversee our first year writing courses here at the university. Right. So I do a lot of writing pedagogy and teacher development, but I still, as much as I can, try to keep my foot, one foot at least, in young adult literature, because it really is something that I found very rewarding as a teacher and as a scholar.
Absolutely. And I think that what you said about using it in the high school classroom to engage younger students in reading is definitely something that I wish that my high school teachers would have done. There was a big focus just on like the classics, like you said, the Scarlet Letter. And I remember we would read, there was one teacher who would assign just like all Charles Dickens, and I did not want to be in that class.
Wow.
I could not handle it. And I wish that he would have maybe used something to bridge us into that rather than just throwing us into the deep end of Dickens. That's
memory for me. That's pretty intense. Yeah.
Yeah. So today, what I wanted to talk to you about is what your article that you wrote in 2013 with Justin Scholes, Understanding the Appeal of Dystopian Young Adult Fiction. So kind of focusing, obviously, a bit on just general YA, but a bit more on young adult dystopian literature. And I think that dystopian young adult is so interesting because it really had such a prolific period of popularity and publishing, and just like the books were constantly being made into movies, and you saw so many teenagers just getting really attached to these characters, myself included. I'm a big Hunger Games fan. So back in 2013, there was obviously that, but as you mentioned, there is Divergent, Matched, and you give a whole list in this article of big books and a lot of the recurring themes that pop up in them. Then you map out like what titles have these themes and how whether or not the inclusion of those might correlate to their popularity. So when you were writing that article, why did you want to write about dystopian young adult literature?
Dystopian literature is just such an interesting, it's just an interesting match with young adult literature, right? We're in Western culture, and especially I'd say American society, we're very protective of young people. We put ratings on movies and video games. We're concerned. You can see that today in this, I would call it overwrought concern about some of what's being taught in classrooms. So this is a really vulnerable, we see them as a really vulnerable group, for better or worse. And yet here's this kind of bleak literature coming in. And I mean, you had Lois Lowry's The Giver.
Yes.
But this wave in the 2010s is very different. And it was just so intriguing to us, I think, that this is a genre that would become so popular with young adults, because it doesn't on its surface seem like a good fit with even with realistic fiction, right, for young adults, because arguably dystopian literature is even bleaker than some of that might be. So I think that was part of it. And like you said, we just saw young people eating this up. And it wasn't just that it was popular, because we've had popular young adult literature that is of questionable quality. Mm-hmm. But some of this, and Hunger Games, I would count, you know, as one of that was really well written.
Yes,
it was embodied some of the perennial dystopian features and characteristics, and didn't sugarcoat things like we sometimes see in young adult literature. And so it was just such an interesting phenomenon for us. We wanted to understand it just a little bit better.
Now, do you think, you mentioned the bleak themes of this dystopian fiction, do you think that some of the appeal for young adults is in the fact that there are those bleak themes? Because you mentioned that a lot of the books have isolation themes. Like you have a protagonist who's isolated. They feel like they can't, you know, make a difference, but they want to in this society where they often feel controlled. Do you think that those bleaker aspects are actually what draw some young people to those books?
I think that's part of it. I think, you know, my experience with high school students, especially, and I work now a lot with, you know, first year college students, and they're not that removed from that high school setting. You know, they are drawn to writers who take them seriously as readers, who recognize their capacity to think deeply about meaningful issues, to tolerate ambiguity and uncertainty. They gravitate towards, especially as older readers, I think they gravitate towards literature that does that for them. And the Hunger Games and other dystopian literature, going clear back to the Giver, I think the best examples of that do trust readers to wrestle with a society that has serious flaws that you have to push deeply to find. You know, you've got to push past the veneer of stability and security and happiness, for lack of a better term, to the underbelly of the society to really understand what's flawed there. And so you need a reader who can go with the protagonist intellectually that way, right? And then to wrestle with ambiguous and dissatisfying endings sometimes. Right.
Absolutely. I think
I think that is a big part of it. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you mention the ambiguous and unsatisfying endings, immediately I think of Divergent. I'm going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, but obviously the main character, Triss, ends up committing suicide at the end of the book. And I remember when that came out, I was probably 15, 14, maybe something like that. And I was involved in a lot of the fan communities, and people were so, there was this a divide between people who were so angry about the ending of the book because it was hard to deal with and hard to understand and maybe grapple with. And then another that was saying, you know, this is how it was going to end for her. She had been through so much. There was so much tragedy and so much trauma, and we don't always get a happy ending type of literature that was coming, that was. And that was my first real like exposure to a book that did not just tie up neatly and where people were very angry and like actively talking about it on, you know, these online communities.
Well, I think we saw that with Hunger Games too, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing Lois Lowry talk about The Giver and how just the tsunami of fan mail she got wanting to know what really happened to Jonas. Like, how did that book really end? Mm-hmm. Was Gabriel alive? Did Jonas like, and she got cute kids who would write endings for her and send them along, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that, and I'm thinking about this Dickens class, right? That you're talking about. Because Dickens can be kind of bleak literature too, but
absolutely, yeah.
But so it's not for young readers. It's not just, oh, is there a ray of hope at the end? Which I will say that I think young adult dystopian literature tends to be a little more hopeful.
Yeah.
Protagonists might have more impact, right? If they don't change the society itself, at least they make peace with it. And they find their own path, right?
Yes.
But these are characters that are more relevant to our students. This is writing that's still good writing, but mm-hmm. much more accessible than maybe Charles Dickens to a 14 or 15 year old. This introducing young people to the idea that not everything's going to end like a Disney movie or a fairy tale, I think is important because they can see that as mm-hmm. as they mature, as they develop, they start to see that, yeah, that life doesn't always have neat endings or happy endings. And they want to see how other characters navigate that. They want to see some of those options. And I know that makes adults nervous when a character, for instance, yes. creates suicide. Mm-hmm. Or commit suicide, pardon me. I know that makes us nervous as adults. But, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that young people deserve to the opportunity to process that as an alternative, as an option, mm-hmm. to think critically about it and to understand why that option ultimately, we hope they would see that it falls short, right?
Yes.
That it doesn't bring about the resolution that they might be thinking of. Yeah. And if you put that juxtaposed with like Jonas and the Giver, who is self-sacrificing and who is, you know, who does something really noble, even if we don't know how it ends up, let's have a conversation about those two outcomes. I think they deserve that. I think young readers deserve that opportunity at least.
Yes. And for Lois Lowry's The Giver specifically, it's definitely considered one of the seminal works in
right.
young adult dystopian. What do you see authors who came after Lowry kind of imitating or taking from her model in The Giver?
That's a really good question. So one of the things, So I think that Lowry obfuscated and had lots of euphemisms, right? Like she's an interesting writer because I think she takes the bleakness of the dystopia and softens it, I think, just a little bit for a younger audience, which was probably critical at the time. Other writers, I think, build on that, like Suzanne Collins in The Hunger Games builds on that and amplifies, I think, some of the ambiguity. You know, we see Katniss really wrestling with more than one regime, right? That comes mm-hmm. in and
absolutely.
And to recognize that, man, maybe it's not about just President Snow. Maybe it's about power and authority.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, so I think there are deeper explorations of some of those issues that Lowry, by laying that foundation and groundwork, allowed writers, other writers in the 2010s and beyond to explore. The one thing that I find really compelling about The Giver, and you see some of this in the critical literature about the novel too, it's this relationship between Jonas and Gabriel. It's this deep, deep human connection.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think you see some of that in adult dystopias, but I think it's particularly relevant to young adult dystopian literature, whether it's romantic or platonic, right? Whatever it is, it's like, I think of that scene early where Katniss, you know, volunteers for her sister so that her sister doesn't have to be in the games.
Yes.
It's that kind of deep human connection that causes you to care for another person that seems to be the counter message to whatever the regime is preaching, right? And I think that much of the best young adult dystopian literature draws that theme and borrows, if you will, from Lois Lowry.
Yes.
In that. I think that's one of the legacies that she left.
Because it's highly emotive, the relationships between the people. And I can recall the first time I read The Giver, and I was in, I think, the seventh grade, and it still sticks out in my mind as one of those books where I was like, yes, this is what it's like to read a book and have it really fit and stick with you and it be relatable, even if, you know, you can't relate exactly to the society or to the position of the protagonist. The same thing with Katniss. Like, I have my own sister, so I can read that and think like, yes, I would do this for her. And that's where those bonds with the protagonists really come in.
Yes. Well, and that's why, you know, to go back to that discussion of Dickens and when I like, this matters to young readers. Like, they care, they're trying to figure out relationships, right? Familial and social and romantic and their position relative to the society as a whole. And that's something that I think dystopian literature helps them start to think about. They care about those things. You know, when they go within and read 1984, which I think is a fine book, the first half is interesting that way, but then the second half just becomes this, you know, this just political diatribe. And they're
exactly
like the relationships and all of that have all fallen away. And that doesn't happen in young adult literature. Those relationships become a driving force throughout the book. And I think that's a big part of why they appeal, not just to young adults, but to adults too, who will cross over and read them.
And to the point about adults also being these being compelling reads to them as well, what do you think beyond the relationships? Because it is written in a quote, simpler manner for the younger audience to understand, but that doesn't discount it from being credible literature. So what do you think draws in the adults? Because there are so many adult readers of YA. Yeah.
You know, that's a really good question. And I'll tell you the first thing, I think the easy answer and the first answer always is the power of the story, right? I remember the time that you're talking about when the Hunger Games movies were so popular and, you know, people who knew the work I did and had kind of been a little skeptical of, oh, you read books written for teenagers and write about it. I mean, it just probably reinforced their sense that the Academy was a useless sort of institution. But when they started to get drawn into the story of Katniss and Pan Am and the Capitol and all this, I just think they started to recognize, oh, like, this is really, you're really just reading good stories. And I'm like, exactly.
Exactly. Yes. That's it.
I love reading good stories. And I love Charles Dickens. And I love The Scarlet Letter. But the first answer, I think, is always about the quality of the story. Mm-hmm. Is it a compelling story? Are these characters we care about? Are the conflicts recognizable? Do they resonate with me? And do I get that feeling that I just want to read one more chapter, right? It's just that, to me, that's the number one explanation for why adults cross over. You know, that's what they love about Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. That's what they love about The Hunger Games or anywhere else we see that crossover. But I also think, and Emma, I'm not like a social scientist. I'm not a political scientist or anything, but I think this time period of the early 2010s, when these books really seem to be sweeping through, you know, it's a post 9/11 world, but we're starting to see this sort of disintegration in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're looking around at the world and we're like, who are we as a country? What are we supposed to be doing? And in many ways, I think dystopian literature does important ideological work to reinscribe certain values and ideologies that are important, like individualism versus collectivism, mm-hmm. which is important to us in American society, I think. And so I think adults were just as interested in reading works that gave us a sense of comfort, like, okay, when things are really bad, someone's going to step up. We're going to have a Katniss, or we're going to have, you know, some group that steps up and says enough is enough. And we're going to revitalize things. I don't know. That can be scary too, right? It's not always guaranteed that a revolution ends up with a positive outcome, but it's part of our American narrative and our American history, right? So I think that there are many adults who want to explore these same questions about what role a government should play, our own complicitness in maybe oppression, and these kinds of things that Suzanne Collins or Ali Condi or Lois Lowry or others write about in ways that do feel a lot easier to access and to get into than maybe your Aldous Huxley's or, you know, George Orwell's.
Yes, I think that that's true. And I love what you said about how it's like that feeling of, I want to read one more chapter. So being drawn into the world and wanting to stay in it, because I find that I've done some tutoring with high schoolers and early college students. And the thing is that they're just not interested. So they don't want to like really apply themselves to reading it, because they get through a chapter and it's like just dragging themselves through the book. So I guess my question about that is, how did you approach teaching high school students young adult literature? And if you did use these books as a bridge, to what novels did you connect them and how? Mm.
Yeah, okay. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that I tried to have a large classroom library. Mm. And, you know, it's unfortunate that as English teachers, especially, we end up spending a lot of our own money on these classroom libraries. But I knew that students were going to need a variety of books to read on their own. And in the 11 years that I taught junior high and high school, I saw many students find that one book. It might have been a Gary Paulsen book. It might have been an Orson Scott Card book. I was always surprised at what the book was. It was, when Twilight was a big deal, it was Twilight for a lot of my high school freshmen. But they found that one book that gave them that rush, that feeling, and it just propelled them mm-hmm. to other books. So I needed to have a wide variety of books available to my students. Yep. And I needed to talk about them. So I would do frequent book talks, just sharing what I was reading or what I had read and really loved, and reading a little bit out of the book I found to be really important for them. I needed them. They had to do independent reading. I made it a requirement in the class, and I gave time to it on a regular basis to show my concern that they had this time to read. And initially, I'll say, as a teacher, I valued fiction more than anything. As time passed, I was a lot more comfortable having them read nonfiction independently, just almost anything, right? You bring in a magazine. Okay, great. Make sure you're reading the articles, right? Like, but I almost stopped caring what they were reading, just as long as they came alive to the power of words. I was teaching in the 90s and early 2000s and didn't have resources I would have loved to have to teach young adult novels as novels. So what I tended to do was use literature circles and little book clubs with my students and have that be a way to introduce them to that young adult literature. So that was the classroom element, and then the independent reading where they could choose literally anything they wanted to read. And, you know, I wish in retrospect that I had been braver and more creative in thinking about how am I going to find the money to buy novels for my 150 students plus to take home, right? I didn't want them to just read it in class. I wanted them to read it at home too. The school would buy me copies of The Scarlet Letter or copies of To Kill a Mockingbird or something like that, but they weren't super happy about buying, you know, copies of a single text of young adult literature. Now that's changing and has changed, I think, a little bit. But in retrospect, I would have done that a little bit differently, I think.
That's so many students to provide books for. I can't imagine. That's fantastic because you're right. We only had the school copies of the classic novels. And then besides that, it was kind of like go out and get it on your own or like maybe it's in the library, maybe not, who knows. So now you're teaching at Brigham and Young. And how did that shift your teaching style between high school students and college students?
Not as much as you might think, and in other ways, a lot. So, like I said in my kind of introduction, I have taught two courses that use young adult literature. One is a course for English majors that our English teaching majors take, but it's open to all majors in the program. And then I teach a general education course, just a literature course. Where I use young adult literature in that class. And in both of those classes, I'd say the major difference in the way I used young adult literature is we talk about the idea of adolescence as a social and cultural construct. And we read some academic work from social scientists about adolescence and its history and the constructed nature of adolescence, both as a phase of life and as a group of human beings. Mm. And then we talk about when we read texts, we talk about those texts as texts themselves. So we'll talk about the story, we'll talk about the thematic elements, other kinds of literary things that we want to talk about. But then we'll also talk about the book as representative of an author's perspective on adolescence as a time and also the adolescent as a person, as a reader. And so we read books like The Giver and Robert Cormier, where with authors who really trust their readers. And then we read other books where, you know, it's a little different relationship that the author builds. And we talk about how that's embedded in some of those cultural constructs, as well as our own memory as adults, right? The way we idealize our own adolescence or the way we complicate it or, you know, things like that. So that's one way that I've settled on using young adult literature as a sort of critical object that we would look at, moving beyond just our response to the story or the literary elements in it, but thinking more about the literature as part of this broader concern in our society about adolescence.
Yes, that's phenomenal. That sounds like a great course.
It's fun to teach. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it's fun to take as well.
I hope so.
So I am intrigued by what you're talking about with like this adolescence, using it as a lens of like, how is it constructed in these societies? And also what you said about the author being an adult themselves and perhaps like idolizing or maybe like looking at their adolescence with rose-colored glasses. Is there a way when you go into these texts that you're saying like, let's try to separate, you know, where we might see this more adult viewpoint coming in an adolescent character? Because I imagine it's very difficult for the authors to separate themselves and constantly be in that like, okay, no, I have to like sound like a teenager, act like a teenager when they're not. They're probably many years removed from being a teenager.
Yeah, Emma, that's such a really good question. And I'll admit that it's been a few years since I've had the chance to teach one of these classes. So I hope I can give you a good answer. And if I start to wander, pull me back and, okay. and ask me a follow-up. But what one of the things, well, first of all, I feel like I ought to respond to the part of the question that I think plagues us as scholars of young adult literature. And I sit on award committees and things like that. And we read these books as adults to give out awards. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we always at some point have to ask ourselves, okay, we love this book. We think this book is amazing. Would teens love it? Right. Like, and you're right. I think we see young adult literature sometimes that's populated with overly precocious or unbelievably precocious characters, right? Who seem way mature beyond their years. And yet, by the same token, we've all worked with young people who seem mature beyond their years. And certainly, I think adolescents don't just want to see themselves reflected in literature. They want to see potential selves reflected, right? I think they want to see, I think that's part of what they love about dystopian literature is, ooh, this protagonist is kind of heroic. I mean, Katniss is like a kick butt character, right? Like she's amazing. And she's, you know, sticking it to the authority. And I mean, there's in so many ways, she's just this, oh, I could be like that. I could have that courage and that potential. But I think this is part of what's complicated about adults in young adult literature is that sort of difficulty of putting ourselves now as adults in adolescents' shoes. But the danger is thinking monolithically about adolescents, right? It's thinking that they're all the same.
Yeah.
And so it's really complicated territory. Now, to what I do in a class, one of the things I like to do is just sort of have us think about, okay, let's talk about this teenager and their, this teenage protagonist and their attributes and their characteristics. What does that tell us about this author's kind of perception of teenagers? I like to have them think about just all the stereotypes that society has about teenagers. They're almost universally negative, right? Yeah. We don't have a lot of positive stereotypes about teenagers, but we look at those stereotypes and then we compare and contrast those to the depictions of these teenagers in literature. And what I try to do with my students is to say, okay, how is this protagonist reinforcing some of those stereotypes? How is the protagonist bucking some of these, right? Questioning, challenging these. And I think good writers draw on both of those probably. Another thing we look at, we sort of build on like literary analysis we might do about themes in the work. And then we build on those and I ask them to think, okay, now let's think about these themes. But now let's think about, okay, this is a book written by an adult to a young writer, and they are not in an equal relationship. They aren't. Mm-hmm. Society places us in an unequal relationship. So there's bound to be a didactic element here, an ideological element. What are those ideologies? What are those ideologies that an adult writer might be trying to convey or instill in their younger reader? It's not necessarily good or bad. It just is, right? And so that's another, and why? Why do they feel like this is what young adults ought to care about, or young adults ought to, a value that young adults ought to embrace? Why would an adult want that to happen? And it's always really interesting because most of the students I teach are, you know, in their late teens themselves or early 20s. They're still in this sort of new adult phase, right? They've left home for the first time. You know, they're voting for the first time or whatever to be, you know, political about it. They're being exposed to all kinds of new ideas. And I think it puts them in really interesting positions to think about their responsibility, not just politically, but socially and in terms of a family they might raise or communities they might be a part of, and how intricate those relationships become. I don't know. I don't know if that's a good answer to your question or not, but
I think that's a great answer, because you mentioned what is so compelling about them is that they can think about the layers of what's going on, and not just in the moment that they're in, but in the future as well, like raising a family, or, you know, they're going to go out and vote. So they're thinking about it. And I think that too is what is compelling about young adult literature to adults, because then they can self-evaluate almost where they're already at and the decisions that they're currently making, the society they're currently in a different way, when they're saying like, look at, you know, the change that this protagonist is trying to make, look at her society. I am older and I can look at it with a different viewpoint and kind of evaluate it in the same way, just at a different time in their life.
Yeah. I think that's a really good insight. And I believe it was Margaret Atwood who talked about how a dystopian society has to be believable, right? It has to be recognizable enough. If it's too distant from our present, then it feels more like fantasy or science fiction.
Yes.
And it maybe doesn't spark the kinds of questions or reflection that you're talking about, Emma, in the sense that. And I've wondered, like, in our modern world where we start to I and many are a little concerned at some authoritarian impulses in Western political institutions. And I don't know if I want to read dystopian literature right now, because I feel like I'm seeing it maybe on the news or there are echoes of it. So you need a little bit of distance, right, to be able to sit and observe it critically. And I think that's one of the brilliant things about using young adult literature in a classroom setting, is that it's recognizable enough and the characters are accessible, the conflicts are recognizable, the society is, there's enough difference. Mm-hmm. But if you think about, I've got this cell phone, and if it's monitoring me now, what if that were like pervasive? Like, what if it listened to everything I said and monitored everything? You know, it's not hard to connect the dots between today and that society. And it encourages us then, I think, to be reflective and critical in important ways. But it has to be believable. It has to be close enough and far enough, right? That sort of sweet spot.
It has to be, because if it's too far of a jump, like you said, it's like science fiction or it's fantasy. And then
and it's entertaining.
In a new world. Yeah, you're entertained, but you're not going to say like, oh, yeah, I can totally picture myself in this scenario, because they're in a different world.
Yeah. Or at the very least, it's harder to do that. Yep. Right. I think, you know, I mean, obviously, books that matter to us are going to speak to us on those in multiple ways and those layers that you're talking about. But yeah, if you hit that sweet spot, and clearly, like, Margaret Atwood, I think, knows how to do that.
Yes,
I think society that's right, and I think Lois Lowry did too, and so did Suzanne Collins and these others. They've been able to create those worlds that feel familiar enough, but yet distant enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have a follow up question to what you're talking about with like the state of right now, the policies, government, also post-pandemic, that kind of thing. We are talking about YA books mostly that were written in the 2010s. And since then, it has been a slightly less popular genre than it was at its like height of popularity. Yeah. But with the state of the world today, the kind of isolation that we're coming out of from the pandemic, the way that social media can both isolate and insulate young people, do you think that we're perhaps headed for another different YA dystopian heyday? And what would that look like?
That's a really good question. And I've given it a lot of thought, you know. I think the isolation that Justin and I saw in that review of dystopian novels in the 2010s was, I mean, as I reflect on it, I think it was like an intellectual isolation where, you know, the protagonist was the only one or one of a small group that saw these flaws in the society, right? And so, excuse me, there was this like, it's alienation almost as much as isolation, but needing to find others who were sympathetic and working together and things like that often was part of the path that protagonist would take. The pandemic is interesting because it certainly raises similar questions, right? Mask mandates and vaccine mandates and things like that feel to some like the kind of authoritarian oppression of a government state run amok, right? And so it is evocative of some of those questions about the surveillance society and our privacy and things like that. Roe v. Wade does similar kinds of things. I think we're seeing a lot of this. And I wonder, Emma, if it's, and again, I'm an amateur at this kind of speculation, right? But I wonder if, because it's so near and so immediate, maybe we don't want to escape to a similar world in our literature.
Yes, yeah.
So we sometimes in young adult literature, you see sort of a counter-revolution, right, to that. Like in the 80s, there was this sort of pushback against the realistic fiction. And we have like Sweet Valley High and these more sort of conservative, traditional sorts of stories that kind of come into popularity because we're just a little bit unsettled by how quickly the realism or the bleakness or whatever it is. So we get these, it ebbs and flows, right? I honestly don't know. I'm really interested because these young people that I work with today, I feel like are more politically savvy, more interested in causes of social justice. I think that's very true for like Gen Z or whatever we're calling this, this group. And maybe their fix is in the real world instead of an imaginary world. I don't know. I don't know. So I don't know. Maybe we need to be in a sort of comfortable level, even though we're still anxious about things. Maybe there needs to be a certain amount of social stability before we're willing to venture into imaginary worlds like that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point you make, because if it's too close, I guess it depends on why your intent when you're reading the book. Like, do you want to escape from your world? Because if you do, then if you're heading right back into one that's exactly like now, you're probably going to be like, oh no, I don't want to read this. And I mean, myself, like when I'm going to pick a book, if I'm feeling like, man, I just want to read something happy, I'm not going to pick a literary fiction that is, you know, very sad themes. Like, that's just not going to happen.
You just want some brain candy.
And I'm
going to
be like, this is great. Like, so that's a good point, because it if you're going for escapism, that's not going to work.
Yeah. And I don't know. Yeah. Because I've seen in some trade journals, you know, I've seen articles about writing about the pandemic. Certainly people in the last couple of years have been writing things. I know that like, and I'm going to forget her name. She wrote, I think it was called Station 11, which was a pandemic. And they did an HBO Max adaptation. Yep. And I was really excited for it. And then I watched the first couple episodes and it was really like in the middle of COVID. And I was like, oh, no, thanks. I wanted to watch it because I love some of the actors in there, but I was just like, this just feels too close to home. So I may be projecting on the society some of my own anxieties and my desires to just, sometimes just want to escape from literature. But I want to believe, and I suspect strongly that our experience through the pandemic will bleed into literature, especially for young adults, because again, we can't help ourselves as adults. We want to nurture. We want to shepherd. We want to help these young adults. And I've listened to so many writers talk about why they do what they do. And they do it because they love these kids. They want them to not only listen and read good stories, but they want to help shape them and help them navigate what is a really tricky time in life. So I suspect that we are going to see this come into young adult literature in some significant way.
Yeah, I think it
may take some time, right?
Yeah, it might need a few years to remove, and then we're going to go back and look and be like, okay, we're going to talk about this, but we're not going to talk about it in the middle of it.
Yeah, like as we're talking, I'm thinking, because I've seen some writers suggest that mystery is kind of a popular YA genre right now. It's sort of...
Yeah, I've seen that. Yep.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, a mystery is really neat. My wife and I love watching police procedurals. And I can't help watching.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
We all love British ones, especially. I don't know if you love British ones too, but I can't help but reflect as we're talking and think, do we like this because there's almost always... like the loose ends get wrapped up, not all of them maybe, but you know who the killer is and you know, the good guys usually win. And maybe in the midst of a pandemic where there's so much confusion, uncertainty in the world around us, maybe we like mysteries. They're not pandemic novels, but there's a clear trajectory of here's our mystery, here's all the clues, and somebody figures it out at the end. Yeah. You know,
that nice wrapping up satisfaction. Yeah.
And that's what we're missing maybe in the world around us. And so we find it somewhere else. I don't know. Like, again, like I said, I feel like I'm a real like amateur armchair psychologist at this or something. But
I know. I agree with all the points you're making. I do. I think that that makes a lot of sense. So shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you when you're, because you're a young adult scholar, which is a new kind of burgeoning field amongst academics. So when you're looking to do research on these books, what attributes do you go for? And is there something about the books that call to you or something in their writing that makes you think like, okay, this is a researchable or, you know, a novel I can analyze?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, at the risk of like seeming like I'm copping out, a compelling story is really important. Because if you're like, for instance, at the end of the article that Justin and I wrote, when we finished it, it had been published and whatnot. I think both of us were like ready to read anything but dystopian literature.
Yeah.
Think it was like a year or two before I even thought about picking anything like that up again. So, you know, when you're going to study a text or a group of texts, you're going to spend a ton of time with them. Mm-hmm. And so they have to be books that you really like, because even if they're really good, you're probably going to get, you know, become tired of them and a little bit weary with them. So it's a good story, I think, for sure. I think if I'm understanding your question, you're asking me about like the characteristics of the literature that I think are worth studying. On the one hand, I think the quality of writing is important. Like, is this a writer that depicts believable characters, you know, with believable conflicts, having believable inner turmoil? I see a lot, and I am not a fan of like dialogue heavy young adult literature.
Okay. Yep.
I like literature where there's more introspection, you know, the books where, you know, because I think that helps that makes me work a little bit harder as a reader sometimes. And again, I'm not a fiction writer, but it feels like dialogue sometimes is doing too much of the work. Anyway, I don't know. I'm on thin ice there, Emma. So let me retrace my steps. Characters are really, really important, I think. And I think young adult writers, you know, Philip Pullman said something about writing for children where he said, that's where the really hard, like, that's the hardest writing to do because those kids don't care. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously. Those kids don't care about your flowery language and your convoluted plots. They just want good story, right? They want good characters that they can relate to. And the other thing I think that the literature has to do is it has to tap into something really meaningful. Mm-hmm. Like I'll give you an example. Like I wrote a chapter talking about this construct of adolescence. It was about Neil Gaiman's book Coraline.
Okay.
And Coraline, if you're not familiar with it, Coraline is kind of this quasi fantastic tale where, you know, this young girl finds a portal into an alternative dimension where she has a mother and a father, like her mother and father, but they're very different and very unsettling. Anyway, it's this sort of kind of archetypal story, but he, in that story, he taps into some really significant questions for Coraline of who she is and where she's going to find courage to do what is right and things like that. And so it's got to tap into something meaningful that way. And I often feel like other scholars of literature sort of look down their noses at young adult literature because they think there is no such thing in young adult. Like, they don't write about meaningful stuff. They're just telling stories and, you know, who am I going to take to the prom and what dress am I going to wear and stuff like that. And sure, there's literature like that for young adults, but there's also literature like that for adults. Like, it doesn't. Yeah, the audience doesn't change the fact that there's higher quality literature and lower quality literature. So I guess maybe that's it in a nutshell, Emma, that there has to be something that you can really sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
Beyond just the power of the story, I think.
I think that's entirely true because, and what you were saying about dialogue, that's very interesting because a lot of times when you go into a book as a literature scholar to, you know, dig into the text and analyze it, you're not necessarily looking at their dialogue as much. You might be looking at it and saying, like, what does this tell me about the character? And, you know, the way they're talking, what they're saying, could that be related to their motives? But you're looking at those big chunks and taking it apart and saying, like, what is the author doing here and why?
Yeah.
So that's a fantastic point that I hadn't thought about. And a lot of the books we're talking about, there is dialogue, obviously, between the characters, building relationships, but there are those moments, as like The Hunger Games obviously comes to mind, where you have the protagonist having those introspective moments and talking almost to themselves in a way.
Right. Or, yeah. And again, I'm not a fiction writer. So, you know, I guess, yeah, I don't want to be one of those critics who criticizes because I can't write fiction kind of thing. But, you know, it just... Yeah. And it's not that they can't be action packed. I mean, one of the things that I think good young adult literature understands is about that story, right? And the right plot moves a reader and engages a reader. And so it's not as though we sometimes, like, there's going to be lots of moments where a character sits back and just reflects every chapter, right? Like, stuff's still got to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm going to be honest with you, Emma. That's a question that I haven't really given a lot of explicit thought to. I just, you know, I usually come at it with, and I admit, like I said, my lens has a lot to do with this construct of adolescence and the ideological function of literature and art, right? And so I'll just read a book like Coraline and just think, oh my gosh, I can tell there's just a lot here that I want to dig into. So it's this more kind of aesthetic response probably at first. But yeah, that's a provocative question. One I'd like to spend more time thinking about.
And I love what you said about studying the books that you like and enjoy, because as scholars, you are spending hours and hours with these texts. So if you really at your core don't like them, it's going to be so hard to engage with them and make meaningful connection because you're not going to have the drive, the want. And that's so similar to what we see in high school students who just they don't want to because they don't like it. And everyone has something they don't like. So.
Right. And why can't we be okay with that? You know, I mean, I work in an English department and sometimes have to embarrassingly admit that I haven't read this classic or that classic, or I'm not a fan of such and such an author that, you know, every English person is supposed to be a fan of. And I think to circle back to a question you asked me about using these in a high school classroom, like as teachers of young people in those settings, I read Twilight. It was not my favorite book to read, but I read it. I liked the first part and the second and the last part in the middle just felt like all about Edward this, Edward that. I got a little tired of that in the middle, honestly. But Emma, that book, I read it one summer and then book talked it for my ninth grade classes. That book was checked out almost continuously the rest of the year. And my students loved it. Like they loved it. And so, you know, I read a lot of sports literature and I love watching sports, but I don't play a lot of sports. But I could recommend books to kids that I knew loved sports, and that might be their hook right into reading. So we have to be wide. I think we have to be wide readers and eccentric readers as teachers of young adult literature. Eclectic, sorry, not eccentric. We're probably all eccentric, but eclectic readers, like picking up lots of different ones because if our goal or one of our goals is to to spread the joy, the love of literature, we're going to have to be able to help lots of different kids with lots of different tastes find that connection.
I think that is just a fantastic point and a great note to end on, because it leaves us at a hopeful point where we are just going to, we're going to go forth. We're going to sign these young adult texts. Yeah. We're going to study them, and it's going to be fantastic.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure. Yeah.
Great conversation. I hope that you enjoyed.
I did. It was fun. Thank you.
And just thank you again. I enjoyed this so much.
You bet.
Wow. So as I said, such an amazing episode with Jonna Stenson. I hope that you guys enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed having this conversation, and come back for more on young adult literature with What Is YA Anyway? Thanks. See you next time.